Well, it's great to be in this space with you all today and to see so many familiar faces. It's always great to have friends when you do this type of work. So the presentation I'm going to do with you today is called Do Black Lives Matter? And this is basically three 90-minute presentations. I've squished it down into a smaller, more compact size for you all this morning. I'm going to try to get through it. I'm going to go through it really quickly. I'm going to try to leave some time at the end for a Q&A. Hopefully, I won't pontificate too much and miss out on that. I do have to leave fairly early, though. I'm part of a group of 42 black leaders that are being honored at the Fiserv Forum before the Bucks game today. So I have to kind of rush out of here to make it there on time. Thank you. So I came up with this presentation. I first did it in 2015. There's a lot of conversation about the Black Lives Matter movement, and I began to ask the question, do Black Lives Matter historically in America? And so I started to look into it, and I created these presentations. And so it covers a lot of history, basically 400 years of history we're going to cover here in about 30 minutes or so. So it's going to be quite the ride for you all, so pay close attention. All right, so we're going to begin by warning you that I'm going to show you a few images that are graphic, that are kind of hard to look at, but I don't show them to you for shock value. I show them to you simply because they're a part of American history. So where did the phrase Black Lives Matter come from? This is something that people aren't typically familiar with. I want to share with you quickly the story. Trayvon Martin, 17-year-old African-American, was killed by George Zimmerman in Sanford, Florida, back in February 2012. And Mr. Zimmerman was tried and acquitted of second-degree murder and manslaughter. And blacks around the country were very upset at the acquittal. And these three young women became a part of what eventually became the Black Lives Matter movement. Alicia Garza said it was as if we had all been punched in the gut. And so they began to kind of talk about it on social media. And she wrote a letter. She called a love letter to black people. And in this, she said, I continue to be surprised at how little black lives matter. Black people, I love you. I love us. Our lives matter. And then her friend Patrice responded that by writing, black bodies will no longer be sacrificed for the rest of the world's enlightenment. I am done. I am so done. Trayvon, you are loved infinitely. Hashtag Black Lives Matter. So that's the genesis of the phrase Black Lives Matter. That's where it comes from, these three women being upset at the acquittal of Trayvon Martin. Most people think that it had something to do with police brutality, but it was actually this particular case that started the movement. So slavery was just the beginning of the devaluation of blacks. We all have learned in our history classes about the enslavement of blacks in this country. I don't think we've learned a great deal of the details of that. I'm going to share a little bit of that with you all today. The one picture of the building, that's a picture in Atlanta, Georgia. That was a slave market. Blacks were sold all over the country. 12 to 15 million Africans were taken out of Africa and enslaved in the New World. 3 to 5% were brought to the United States of America and sold here beginning in 1619. And the last actual ship that arrived was right before the Civil War began in 1861. But they were sold in multiple places, and they were sold multiple times. It wasn't just the one time that they were sold typically. So let's talk a little bit about American history. So this is kind of a pie of American history. Legal slavery lasted for 62% of American history, 246 years. So I consider American history to be the beginning. It's actually a little bit longer. So 1607 when the first pilgrims came over, but the first Africans arrived in 1619. And so after slavery ended in 1865, we had a short period known as Reconstruction, which lasted 12 years where blacks were given their freedom for the first time. So slavery was ended officially. Black men were given the right to vote, and blacks became citizens for the first time in the United States. But that was short-lived. In 1877, that ended, and we saw 91 years of Jim Crow segregation, which is the norm around the country. And then we've been in what people refer to as post-civil rights movement for only 51 years. So only 12.5% of American history have we as black people lived in a society that actually said they would treat us okay. So that hasn't been a very good experience for us. So let's talk about the first Africans who arrived. They arrived on a ship that people refer to as a Dutch man of war, but it was actually a British ship with a Dutch flag on it. 20 or so of these individuals were actually stolen. The ship that they came over as a slaving ship, and that was attacked by a pirate ship. And this pirate ship eventually came to Jamestown, Virginia, and sold them because they ran out of food and water. They needed food and water. They sold these 20 Africans. And every historian tells you in your history class that they were indentured servants. Indentured servants were people who signed a contract of indenture. These were people in Europe who in many cases were forced to sign this letter of indenture, but they were forced and sometimes volunteered to come to the New World, to the colonies in America, and they were forced to work for 4 to 7 years, and then they were given their freedom, and then they could do whatever they wanted to do with themselves. The reason that historians tell you that these Africans who never signed a letter of indenture because they came over on a slaving ship, the reason they tell you that they were indentured servants instead of slaves is because no colony at that time had actually written the law codifying slavery as a legal institution. So even though the institution existed, it wasn't written into the laws yet. So don't believe that they were indentured servants. They were not. They came over on a slaving ship, just as many, many millions of others. So in 1641, Massachusetts was the first colony to recognize slavery by writing a law. And at the 1787 Constitutional Convention, 25 of the delegates there were slave owners. It was very popular to be a slave owner, especially among the elites of American society. And interesting enough, if you read the Constitution, the word slave and slavery were not written in the Constitution. The first time you see the word slave is actually in 1865 with the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which says that slavery and involuntary servitude are illegal except as punishment for a crime you've been duly convicted of. So slavery is still perfectly legal in the United States. And there are at least 10 parts of the Constitution that directly support the institution of slavery. So we began as a nation that supported and rationalized slavery. 3 years after the Constitution was ratified in 1787, nearly 700,000 blacks were enslaved in the country. And on the eve of the Civil War, the last census done before the Civil War in 1860, nearly 4 million blacks were enslaved in the country. About 92% of all blacks in the country in 1860 were actually enslaved. So only about 8% were free at that time. These are the years of legalized slavery by state. So Virginia had legalized slavery for 204 years, Maryland 202, so on and so forth. And one of the interesting things about this list is that the states that we typically associate with slavery, those southern states like Mississippi, Alabama, they had slavery for a much, much shorter period of time than some of the other states were in the North. All of the original 13 colonies had slavery on the books. They got rid of it. They used a tool that they call gradual emancipation. So they didn't just say, we're going to emancipate you in the law. For instance, in New York in 1827, the history books will tell you that New York got rid of slavery in 1827. But what New York actually did was they said, we're going to end the institution of slavery. However, if you are an enslaved black, if you are a female, you will continue to be enslaved until the age of 18. So if you're a little three-year-old girl, you got 15 more years of slavery to go. And if you're a black male who's enslaved, you will be enslaved until the age of 21. So if you're a little four-year-old boy, you got 17 more years of slavery. So even though the books tell you that slavery ended in a particular year, in a particular place, it didn't necessarily end because of those grandfather clauses they put in. And so people are surprised to see that Indiana had slavery on the books as well. Slavery was never a legal institution in the state of Wisconsin. However, there were many blacks who were held in servitude in the state. So this is what I call the Bill of Rights Denied. These are slave codes. These were laws written specifically to make sure that blacks, whether they were free or enslaved, would not have the benefits of the Bill of Rights. So enslaved Africans could be awarded as prizes in raffles, wagered in gambling, offered as security for loans, and transferred as gifts from one person to another. In fact, when I traced my family history, I was fortunate enough to come across a woman was tracing her family history. The man who owned my family in Mississippi, his name was Dempsey Dilts. He came over to America from Germany and landed in South Carolina and purchased some slaves, eventually moved them to Mississippi, a little place called Tillatoba, Mississippi. And when he passed away, he left all of his worldly possessions to his second wife, Mary. He married two Marys. He must have liked Marys. His first wife was Mary, second wife was Mary. And so this woman who was also tracing her family history was Dempsey Dilts' great, 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 great granddaughter. She sent me his entire family history, and included with that package she sent me was a copy of Mary Diltz's final will and testament. And so I was able to look at this document and see that not only was she giving away her worldly possessions, like the land that she owned, the furniture in the house, you know, the cattle that she owned, she was also giving away my family members. She gave some of my family members to her son, who ended up moving to Texas. She gave some to her daughter, who ended up moving to Georgia later. So they were just passed along just like any other piece of property that someone owned. In addition to that, the education of Africans were prohibited. If you were caught teaching them to read or write, you could go to jail and be fined. Missouri would fine you $500 and send you to jail for 6 months for teaching blacks to read. But many still were able to learn to read. Despite that, marriages between enslaved Africans were never legally binding. Therefore, owners were free to break up families on a pretty regular basis. In fact, the English colonies where slavery existed were the worst in terms of breaking up families. Typically, the Spanish and the Portuguese who enslaved Africans tended to keep the families together, but the English and the French broke families up on a regular basis. So here in the United States, families were split up regularly. And since the enslaved African woman was considered chattel or just property, no one could be accused and charged with raping a black female. And so rape was exceptionally common on the plantations around the United States. In addition to that, they could not assemble without a white person being present. And they were held incompetent as witnesses in legal cases where whites were involved. They could testify against other blacks, but they could not testify against whites. An enslaved African found guilty of arson, rape of a white woman, or conspiracy to burial was put to death. Rape of a black woman, there were no charges. So, the most prominent tool to maintain slavery was violence. Violence was a part and parcel of how you kept people in servitude for a very long period of time, and they were actually given a license to kill. Legislators expressly deprived slaves who were violently abused by whites of the protections of the common law by passing exculpatory acts that granted both slave masters and whites who were strangers to the slave legal rights to beat, whip, and kill bondsmen. And nothing would happen to you. The only time something would happen is if you kill someone's slave, then you would have to pay them compensation for the loss of their property. The Dred Scott decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1857 talked about the conditions of these enslaved Africans and said they had for more than a century before been regarded as beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, and the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit. Words of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1857. Slavery ended in 1865, but as I told you earlier, the institution of slavery is still legal as punishment for a crime you've been newly convicted of. So we started a system called the convict lease system shortly after legalized slavery ended, and mostly African-American men, some white men, but mostly African-American men were accosted, accused of minor crimes, and then sentenced to labor. They were sold to different individuals and businesses, and they were forced to work for those people until they paid off that debt. And in many cases, they hadn't committed any crimes. In fact, they wrote laws specifically for activities that blacks were a part of on a regular basis, and they made those illegal, and whites who did the exact same thing would not face any punishment. So they really actually criminalized being black. And so these people were forced to work for no pay. Many of them died in the course of this work. Many of them were taken away from their families for years on end. And this system continued to exist all the way through the 1930s. So slavery didn't end. There's a great book written about this called Slavery by Another Name. If you haven't read it, it's a great read. And there's a great documentary by the same name that goes along with the book. Jim Crow segregation was not just about segregated spaces. It was about segregated mindsets, denying blacks basic human rights. So Jim Crow became a shorthand for the laws, customs, and etiquette that segregated and demeaned African Americans. So the 1896 Supreme Court decision case called Plessy v. Ferguson. They basically said that segregation of the races is perfectly okay and normal, and that became the law of the land, that segregated spaces should be created and allowed. And even though in the North you didn't see those signs that said colored waiting rooms and white water fountains, Jim Crow existed in the North as well. There's a great book written about Milwaukee, which talks about how blacks were segregated in Milwaukee, called The Jim Crow of the North. So the enduring legacy of Jim Crow is how we as a nation have shown the world how we feel about black people. The images that we see, you know, there's been a great deal of controversy recently with the governor of Virginia, the attorney general of Virginia, being accused of wearing blackface and both admitting that they did at some point wear blackface. Well, guess what? I've been telling people this for a number of years. Do not be surprised to see more incidents like this, because they happen on a regular basis. The times where I've noticed we see these blackface images the most, Halloween parties that whites have. Martin Luther King Day, whites have parties to celebrate Martin Luther King Day, and they dress in blackface to mock Dr. King. And also during the month of February, Black History Month, you will see these if you pay attention. It's not something new. It's been around for a very long period of time. We continue to do it. We created segregated spaces on purpose, legally created segregated spaces, by creating redlining maps around the country from 1934 to 1940 in 239 cities. The federal government drew maps redlining different neighborhoods. If you lived in a redlined neighborhood, that was a neighborhood where you could not get access to a loan to purchase a home or a business. And every one of those 239 cities they drew the maps in, the black section of town was always redlined, making it exceptionally difficult for blacks to get loans to purchase homes, and therefore making sure that blacks would not have that ability to build generational wealth by becoming homeowners, and making sure that whites had access to those loans. And that's really why white home ownership rate today is so much higher than it is for blacks. We also created what are known as racial restrictive covenants around the country. This is a sign that was in Wauwatosa, all around the community of Wauwatosa, and it said, entering Wauwatosa City of Homes, restricted zoning. They had what were called racial restrictive covenants, and these were legally, these were attached to the deeds of property, legally binding, that said only certain people can live in these particular neighborhoods. And in many cases, they specifically stated blacks can't live in these neighborhoods. Only whites can live in these neighborhoods. And out west, Native Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos couldn't live in certain neighborhoods. And these were widespread here in the Milwaukee metropolitan area. Of all of the suburbs of Milwaukee within Milwaukee County, Wauwatosa had more of those than any other. In fact, that sign is a picture that I took at the Wauwatosa Historical Society, but they also had that sign inside City Hall in Wauwatosa for a number of years. In fact, they just took it out last year. And someone along the way realized that that sign was problematic, and they went into City Hall and they put some green duct tape over the part at the bottom that says restrictive zoning, as if no one would know what it meant. Racial violence continues after slavery ends. We're going to talk about white mob violence, lynchings, race riots that occurred that you probably don't know a whole lot about. Lynchings were public spectacles attended by thousands in many cases. You see here, 3,000 were burned Negro. A man by the name of John Hartfield was lynched in Ellisville, Mississippi, in 1919, and it was announced in the papers the day before. In nearly all recorded lynchings, an investigation by the authorities said that the victim was killed by parties unknown, even though everybody knew exactly who the parties were. In many cases, people posed for pictures, and you could see who they were, but it didn't matter. It was very rare that the people who lynched these individuals were called to task by the local authorities. 4,742 lynchings were recorded from 1882 to 1968, including 3,444 blacks, 1,297 whites. However, many of those described as white were actually not white. They were Mexicans, they were Native Americans and Asians, but they were listed as whites. So the number of people who were lynched that were white was actually pretty small. This is a photograph of one of those white race riots. I tell people that you've heard about the race riots that occurred in the 1960s around the United States of America, but you haven't heard about those riots that whites led into black communities where they burned businesses, burned people's homes, looted businesses, beat, killed blacks with no one having the ability to stop them. This is probably the most famous. This is actually Tulsa, Oklahoma, and this is a postcard that someone wrote a little message on it, and it says, "Running the Negro out of Tulsa, June 1st, 1921. 35 square blocks of the black part of Tulsa was completely leveled by fire. The largest black-owned hotel in the United States was in Tulsa. It was destroyed. Every black church was burned. Every black home was burned. Every black business was burned. Over 300 blacks were killed, and most of the blacks who were living in Tulsa had to flee the city permanently." Major weight. White race riots occurred throughout the 20th century, 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina. There was a coup d'etat where the black elected leaders were actually forced out of office and replaced by whites. There was a major race riot in Atlanta, Georgia, Springfield, Illinois, so on and so forth. You can see the list. In East St. Louis, William Tuttle reports that the state troops fraternized and joked with lawbreaking whites, and many were seen helping in the murders and arson. So they were called in to quell the riots, and they actually participated in the riots. In the summer of 1919, it's known as Red Summer. Nearly 30 major race riots occurred around the country, from Chicago to Bisbee, Arizona, to Philadelphia, to Port Arthur, Texas, and many, many other places around the country. They were very, very common. Devaluation of blacks in the scientific community has a very long, ugly history. This is an image of some of the people who were part of what was known as the Tuskegee experiment, which we'll talk about shortly. Blacks were used as guinea pigs. Black corpses were dug up and sold to medical schools to be used as cadavers. So practically every doctor in the United States during the days of slavery practiced on black cadavers after their bodies had been dug up shortly after they were buried. Both enslaved blacks and freedmen were used in hospitals for experiments conducted without their knowledge. And in addition to that, both slave owners treated blacks themselves. Doctors were only called as a last resort. So many people suffered tremendously and died because doctors weren't called to treat their illnesses. The father of gynecology, James Marion Sims, the little known part of his life is that he conducted these experiments that led to gynecology, the science of gynecology, by doing these horrible experiments on black women that he purchased, enslaved black women he purchased, and he did these experiments on them without anesthesia or consent. And he did this for many, many, many years. There was a big memorial statue to him in New York City that was removed just a few years ago because people finally said, why are we memorializing this man after he did such horrible things? Tuskegee syphilis experiment from 1932 to 1972. There's a short video I want you to watch about this.
Dirt poor sharecroppers in Macon County, Alabama. Black men with syphilis. From 1932, 339 men were told by the Public Health Service, the forerunner of today's CDC, that they had bad blood. The motive of public health doctors was to study the natural history of syphilis in the black man. Natural history in this case means deliberately untreated. These men were deliberately left untreated even when something as effective as penicillin came along. Worse still, those infected were actively prevented by public health doctors from getting this life-saving drug. Men suffered and died. Women continued being infected, and babies continued to be born with congenital syphilis. A shiny new CDC took over in the late 1960s, refused to stop the experiment. Not until every last man had been opened up on their autopsy table. The experiment was stopped, not because the CDC realized the barbaric nature of their enterprise, but because a whistleblower by the name of Peter Buxton leaked the story to a journalist at the Washington Star. The story was published on July 25th, 1972, hit the front page of the New York Times, and the experiment was stopped shortly thereafter. Congressional hearings followed. So unethical, so inhumane was this public health experiment that it led to a change in the CDC's code of medical ethics.
Despite those congressional hearings, no one, not a single individual involved, was ever held accountable and punished for that experiment. So this has led to a history of blacks being treated differently by the medical establishment and a great deal of distrust in the black community of the medical establishment. Black Americans are systematically undertreated for pain relative to white Americans. There has always been a belief in America that blacks don't feel pain in the same way that whites did. In fact, so-called scientists told us that that was the case throughout most of the 1800s and about the first 50 years of the 20th century. That was common knowledge, that blacks didn't feel pain the same way that whites did. Evidence shows that white lay people and medical students, even today, as well as residents, believe that the black body is biologically different and in many cases stronger than the white body. So we're treated differently. We're not asked the same questions when we go to the doctor. We don't get the same level of treatment, and therefore we die prematurely because we don't get the same level of treatment as whites. Life expectancy gap around the country has been shrinking. The difference between how long blacks and whites live has been shrinking. That gap has been getting smaller in every state except one, Wisconsin. We are the only state where the gap is growing wider and wider and wider, and that is shameful that we are the only state. Dr. King said these words at the march in 1963, the March on Washington's famous I Have a Dream speech. These are some of the words he spoke. "We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of unspeakable horrors of police brutality." Most of you have probably never heard or read the entire I Have a Dream speech. You've only heard the part at the end about the dream. Guess what? That wasn't even supposed to be part of this speech. It is a famous picture of Dr. King holding some papers in his hand, and as he's giving the prepared speech that he had written, that he completed the night before, Marian Anderson said, "Martin, tell him about your dream." And he discarded the rest of his prepared speech, and he told that story of the dream, which is a part of a sermon he did on a regular basis. So those words were not even part of it. If you haven't already, look for the full text of the I Have a Dream speech. Look it up and read it. It'll be much different than you think it is. It's a very powerful speech. So we in the black community have had issues with the police in many places, including in Milwaukee. This was a case back in 2012 where these four officers, and there were many others who were implicated, but these were the ones that were actually punished. They were charged with felonies related to illegal rectal searches of suspects on the street and in police districts from 2010 to 2012 around the city of Milwaukee. They were literally making black men mostly, but some black women as well, literally take their clothing off in the middle of the street, their clothing, their underwear, and they did anal cavity searches of these individuals. And they complained over and over and over and over and over. Nothing was done for over 2 years until finally a Journal Sentinel reporter did a story about it, and they were finally decided to do something. And even though the officers were punished, they were punished under plea bargains where they made sure that none of these officers, because actually what they were doing fits the FBI's definition of rape. None of them were charged with rape. None of them were forced to be registered as a sex offender after this. And they were given a slap on the wrist for the most part. They were given anywhere from 10 to 60 hours of community service, and from 20 days in jail to 26 months. Michael Vanini was given 26 months in prison. There were six charges that he was facing, including sexual assault, that were dropped in the plea bargain. And that's why he only did 26 months. If he had been charged and convicted on all of the charges, he would have spent over 75 years in prison instead of 26 months. In one case, an officer held a gun to a man's head as two others held his arms and put him in a chokehold while jamming a hand into his anus, purportedly searching for evidence. And another man bled from his rectum for several days after his encounter with police. So this is brutal, just horrible treatment. And this is part of the reason that blacks are so distrustful of the police department in Milwaukee. It's not just anecdotal things. These are things that people have literally survived and told other people about. And for many years, whites have refused to believe that the police treat black people differently than whites, despite the evidence that's there. disparities in police killings nationwide. I'm going to just kind of explain this to you. So in 2015, there were 1,152 people nationwide who were killed by police. 50% of them were white, 26% were black, 17% Latino, and 7% others. And you can see the population percentage. So whites are underrepresented, blacks are overrepresented, Latinos are represented about the same percentage as well as others. But that year, and one of the arguments that people try to make is that, well, a police officer is constantly killed. Majority of police officers who die in the line of duty are not killed. They die in car accidents. Some officers have actually accidentally shot themselves or their partners. In fact, of all the officers, there were 285 officers killed in 2015, and only 41 of them were actually shot and killed. Five were actually physically assaulted and killed. So it's very rare for police officers to be killed, to be murdered. Most of the police officers that die in the line of duty every year are not killed. They die in accidents, helicopter crashes, state trooper car crashes on its way to an accident or whatever. That's how a majority of police officers die. In 2016, police killed 1,146 people nationwide, 48% white, 24% black, 17% Latino, 11% others. 64 officers were shot and killed that year. 2017, 1,147 people were killed by police nationwide, 47% white, 23% black, 19% Latino, 12% other, 45 officers were shot and killed that year. And then in 2018, 1,166 people were killed by police, 41% white, 20% black, 13% Latino, 26% other. And the interesting thing about the year 2018, those 52 officers who were shot and killed, you know, we began to hear a lot more about police officers being killed because of the Black Lives Matter movement protesting police, killing blacks. And people started saying, well, what about all of the police officers that are killed? But they didn't give you enough information for you to understand that most police officers are not shot and killed. In fact, you may have heard the last year we've lost two Milwaukee police officers who've been shot and killed, right? And then there's a third who died in a car chase chasing someone, and he lost his life. So three tragic losses of Milwaukee police officers. But most people aren't aware that those officers who died in 2018 and 2019, those officers, that was the first time since 1994 that a Milwaukee police department officer lost his life in the line of duty. First time since 1994. But you would not know that if you listen to certain media organizations. So unarmed people, a number of people who are unarmed are killed. 149 unarmed people were killed by police in 2017, the last year that full data is available. One of every eight people killed was unarmed. In fact, 92% of people who were killed by police in 2017 were either shot or tased to death. People don't understand how many people die every year from being tased by the police. It's not just police officers shooting people and killing them. They tase people and people die on a regular basis. And we refuse to take tasers away from officers, even though we know that they're literally killing people. We continue to allow them to do it. And when you talk about the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests against police brutality, they are not talking about police just randomly killing black people. They understand that officers' jobs are dangerous and sometimes they have to take people's lives. They don't have an issue with that. What they have an issue with is when a person is unarmed and no real threat to a police officer, yet they're shot and killed. There is no reason for a heavily armed, well-trained police officer to take out their weapon and shoot someone who is not a threat because they don't have a weapon. Yet that's always the excuse that police use in every case. And the reason that they use that excuse in every case, that they fear for their lives, is because the U.S. Supreme Court has given them permission. There's a famous U.S. Supreme Court case that basically said, as long as an officer fears for his life or the lives of other civilians in that encounter, they have the right to take a person's life. So whether it's justified or not, in the eyes of the black community, in many of these cases they're unjustified, the law simply allows them to get away with it. Remember, I showed you earlier that during the days of enslavement, that whites had a license to kill black people with no punishment. It's still the case today. People don't understand, well, why is it that all these officers always get off? Why is it always justified? It's always justified because all they have to say is that they feared for their lives. Whether they did or not, it doesn't matter. As long as they say they did. The officer who shot Laquan McDonald in Chicago a few years ago, and you can see the video that Laquan McDonald was walking away. He was no threat. He had a knife in his hand, but he's walking away. The officer shot him 17 times, unloaded his revolver, loaded it again, fired some more shots, killed Laquan McDonald. They lied about it for over a year, and that officer was convicted because the video showed the man was not a threat. The officer in North Carolina who shot a black man, Walter Scott, in the back, who was clearly running away, and a pedestrian was videotaping it, clearly running away. The officer shot the man, Walter Scott, in the back multiple times because he had a busted taillight on his car, and he was chasing this man because he had a busted taillight, and he shot Walter Scott in the back multiple times, killed him, and then planted a weapon next to his body, not knowing that a civilian was videotaping it with his cell phone. And so we from the black community, we know that these things happen on a regular basis. We hear about them. We never question them because we're so accustomed to hearing these stories. And it's not something recent. These things have been happening for decade after decade after decade. We know about it. We've seen it. White people did not know about it because they haven't seen it. They needed physical evidence. And fortunately, we have video cameras on people's phones now. We're seeing these viral videos. But even though many viral videos have been out there of unarmed blacks killed by police, they're still being acquitted. So we from the black community, when we talk about Black Lives Matter and protest these things, we're protesting the fact that people can literally just take an innocent person's life for no reason other than the fact they choose to. And then they say, oh, I was in fear. I just don't believe it. So we can see that the rate of unarmed black men killed by police is significantly higher than it is for Hispanics as well as whites. And even though it's gone down, I think the reason that these shootings have gone down of unarmed people is because of the Black Lives Matter movement, because of all of the viral videos, because of all of the national attention that's been given to these issues. That's why you've seen a decrease over the last few years. Had there never been a Black Lives Matter movement, had there not been all of these viral videos and all of these protests around the country, you would continue to see those numbers the way they were before. So I believe very strongly that the protests have made a huge difference, that officers are being trained differently, that officers now are thinking before they're pulling the trigger and shooting somebody unnecessarily. So they are actually working. Disparities in the use of the death penalty. Now, this is an interesting piece here because I looked at the data for how the death penalty is used across the country. It's very rare for the death penalty to be used. Less than 1/10 of 1% of all cases, a person is facing the death penalty. However, if you look at all of the people who've been executed since 1976, and this is data from back in November of last year, 1,486 people have been executed since the Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty was legal again and had been illegal for about 3 years. They brought it back in 1976. 1,486 people have been executed across the country for murdering people. However, a majority of those people who have been executed have been executed for killing white people. And we all know, if you pay attention to the news, that a majority of people killed in the United States are black. A majority of the people that kill them are black. However, the way the death penalty is used, it doesn't show that. It shows that white victims' lives are more important. Let me show you the numbers. So people were executed who killed blacks, 333, only 15% of all the people executed since 1976. People who kill Latinos, 153 people who kill Latinos were executed, 6.9% of all of those people executed. 1,646 of the people executed, 75.6% have actually had white victims. Now, the numbers, you see 1,646. That's because many of these were mass murderers. It's included the bombers of Oklahoma City. You remember the terrorist attack on Oklahoma City. So many of these people actually killed multiple victims, not just one. And then other victims, 2.3%. So you can see the disparities there, but it goes even deeper because this is what it looks like. Blacks who were executed, who had a black victim, 182 blacks have been executed for killing other blacks. 305 blacks have been executed for killing white people. Let me repeat that. 182 blacks have been executed for killing other black people, but 305 have been executed for killing white people. And when you look at whites, 781 have been convicted of killing whites, and only 34 have been given a death penalty for killing a black person. And if we look at homicides, according to FBI data, 93% of blacks are killed by blacks, 84% of whites are killed by whites. So huge disparities. And this shows very clearly, and it's been argued at the U.S. Supreme Court, that the death penalty should be gotten rid of because of the racial discrimination and racial disparities. And the Supreme Court actually agreed that these racial disparities are unconstitutional, that they are illegal. However, this is what they've said in those cases. Even though the evidence clearly shows that racism plays a role in how the death penalty is used, unless you have the ability to show that race played a role in your specific case, sorry, it doesn't matter. You have to prove that there was intentional efforts by the authorities to execute you as a black person. And how do you prove that? How do you prove that? It's impossible. So, disparities by the Milwaukee Police Department. 48% of traffic stop records and 59% of the pedestrian stop records fail to show that the Milwaukee Police Department officers conducting stops had reasonable suspicion of criminal activity or a traffic or vehicle equipment violation. So when we tell you that driving while black is real, when we tell you that the cops pull us over for nothing, we are not exaggerating. The evidence that the Department of Justice found when they looked into Milwaukee Police Department records when they came to do an investigation showed that clearly officers were pulling people over without any reasonable cause to pull them over if they were black. And we in the black community know this because we see it every day. But the evidence is there because the Department of Justice did an investigation. In fact, in District 6, blacks are only 3% of the people that live in that district, but they were 64% of the people that were pulled over by cops in that district. 3% of the people who live there, 64% of the people pulled over by cops from 2011 through 2015. If that's not racial profiling, I don't know what is. And as a result of that Department of Justice investigation, ACLU filed a lawsuit against the Milwaukee Police Department, and the Milwaukee Police Department has been forced to change their practices. This is the difference between traffic stops and traffic searches. Blacks are 65.6% of traffic stops, 74% of people who are searched in traffic stops. Whites are 21%, 21.7% of those who are stopped, 12.6% of those searched, even though drugs and the weapons are discovered in less than 1% of such stops. Black and Latino drivers are more than 20% less likely to lead to discovery of drugs and searches of white drivers. Do you know why that's the case? Because white people know the cops aren't going to pull them over. So they have a little bag of weed sitting in their car because they know the cops aren't going to pull me over. If they see a group of young black guys in the car, they're probably going to pull them over. I've had young white people pull up next to me and ask me, dude, do you have any papers? I'm like, what are you talking about? Papers? What kind of papers? And then I figured out, oh, they're looking for like some papers that are rolling marijuana, right? And so one day this happened to me. I was getting ready to get on the freeway. And it was like four white kids in the car, and they pulled up next to me. And they said, sir, do you have any papers? And this was the second time someone had asked me. So now I knew, okay, I know what they're talking about, right? So I grabbed my notebook, and I said, here, these are the papers I have. And they kind of looked at me and drove off kind of mad that I didn't have the right papers. Anyway, last few things I want to share with you. So people think that stop and frisk is related to the level of crime that happens in Milwaukee. It doesn't. As the crime, number of crimes reported to police have been dropping from 2007 to 2012. In fact, a 19% drop in crimes reported to the police. Stop and frisk increased by 504%. Crime going down. Stop and frisk going up. That tells you that the stop and frisk are not related to crime. That's what the police department and the chief tried to tell us, that crime is increasing. Crime has been dropping. And if you look at the numbers, 48,000 in 2007, 2015, the last year that numbers are available, only 35,000 crimes reported to police. So the policing does not match the level of crime in the city. And this is, I believe, the last slide I have for you. Incarceration rates. We have the highest incarceration rate of black males of any state in the country. We have the second highest incarceration rate for blacks overall, if you include black men and women. Black adult males are only 2% of the population in the state, but we account for 42% of the male prisoners. Black females are 2% of the population in the state, but are 21% of female prisons. And you can see the black incarceration rate per 100,000 is significantly higher than it is for Latinos as well as whites. And in fact, we are in the worst shape of any state in the country when it comes to these particular things. So thank you all so much. Appreciate your time.